Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
That's a fact, like Agnes, Agatha, Jermaine, and Jack.
And Justin Robert Young.
Hey, it's me, Justin.
Well, I'm going to just give a shameless plug right off the top of the show because there are only 3 days left. I'm part of a Humble Bundle with Kevin J. Anderson and some other great authors. If you go to humblebundle.com, click on the Wordfire Sci-Fi Specials. If you get this thing like Wednesday, you can check, but I think it'll be gone. But if you're watching or listening right now or the next day or two, check it out. Name your price. It's got some great books, including free previously unpublished Frank Herbert novels. That's right, the guy who wrote Dune. These books were considered a little bit too weird for their time, but right now would probably be perfect. Also included in there is we've got an Alan Dean Foster story. There's my stuff and another collection of great authors. So check that out at humblebundle.com. None of these proceeds will benefit the show Weird Things at all, but they will help the Challenger Space Science Center for Space Education, which helps kids learn about space and science, and the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers Association, and they've got a Givers Fund, which helps out really important causes in science fiction. So check that out. That is the Humble Bundle Sci-Fi Specials, and it's going to be gone soon. Now's the chance. Now's your chance. Like, name your price. You could go in there, put in $5 and get the first tier. I think pay like 15 and you get 18 books, actually 22 books, 22 ebooks for one super low price.
I went in for $25 and it was a great decision. What a wealth, a treasure trove of awesome books.
I'm going to
thank you for your support.
You're going to have to cover me as I do the 25 tier. Actually, I'm going to do 26.
Humble Bundle. So here's a fun fact on Boing Boing. Kevin J. Anderson had an article up explaining the fact that given the number that we sold in the first week, all of the authors in there would classify as bestsellers, you know, because having sold several thousand. But because of the way bestsellers are counted, it doesn't count. But it is sort of the weird economics that we live in. But bundles are a great way to you find a couple things you like and help out some authors and help out some great causes.
Awesome possum, man. No, everybody, go ahead and grab the Humble Bundle when you can. Only 3 days left. This is not something that's going to be there forever. No. Don't walk.
Exactly. It has been an exciting week. Let me tell you guys, I'm going to remind you of an episode we had a few months back where I breathlessly described this really cool presentation that a NASA scientist by the name of Phil Lubin did, explaining his ambitious idea for sending a space probe to another star system, the Alpha Centauri, using light propulsion, laser propulsion, where you would have a bank of lasers on the ground in an array that could project a beam thousands of miles out and accelerate something, let's say, a meter-wide sail to 30% the speed of light, where it could reach our next nearest star in 15 years, which means, you know, from within our own lifetime, we could be sending probes around another star. Crazy, but feasible. And he had an entire, 60-page research paper explaining this. This isn't some, and then we get dark matter here or exotic matter here. It's not some Alcubierre drive or even some theoretical one day when we have fusion kind of thing, which I think will happen. This is all real tech right now. You could buy off the shelf. You just have to scale it up and solve some engineering problems, but it's not a far-fetched thing. But anyhow, we talked about this and how exciting that would be and how that could scale to actually sending larger probes. You could put a payload, like a 1 kilo payload on Mars in 30 minutes. You could actually send a human spacecraft to Mars in a couple of days using this technology. Well, there was an announcement this week. Billionaire Yuri Milner, who had previously put some money into SETI, along with advisors including Stephen Hawking and Zuckerberg, has announced this Starshot, which is the plan to send exactly what Lubin described, a probe. And Lubin is on board the advisory group here to send a probe to Alpha Centauri. He's putting $100 million in to get this thing going. It's still going to take more money and resources to make this thing happen, but this has become a real thing. And exciting to see something that Lubin was talking about you know, a few months ago that you can actually still find his NASA presentation and to see this thing happening. Of course, you know, of course, a little bit weird. People are like, oh, Stephen Hawking's plan for this. I love Stephen Hawking, but it's not Stephen Hawking's plan. This is largely, sure, sure, to my understanding.
But, was, but, know, but I mean, that's work. That's one of those things where it's like Stephen Hawking knows and Yuri Milner knows that that attaching Stephen Hawking, like that's why everyone's calling it Stephen Hawking's, you know, plan is extreme value to his participation.
Yes. That doesn't make that it's true, but yes, that is correct. It's why you bring his name in there and Zuckerberg in there is because they will get attention to it. And Lubin is part of this, and that's what's critical important is this is – and other people talk about that, but he was, as far as I know, the guy that really pushes forward. But to me, it's just rooting for the guys, the women who do the real – who kind of do the work and have the vision. You kind of want to see them get recognition and not just the bigger name, you know, get like, oh, you know, so-and-so's like, well, that's the person you know, and so you say that it's them. But it's great that Stephen Hawking is helping support this and lending his name to it. That's fantastic.
So I'm certain. I mean, oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I mean, yeah, and obviously the machinations of this continuing to get money and public support and press that keeps the project going is critical. But you know, also so is giving credit to the people that are actually getting it started. I'm curious though as to how much the success of SpaceX and Blue Origin, specifically when it comes to the press, really affects an announcement like this, because I certainly can envision a world not that long ago where an announcement like this is made. It kind of makes some waves in certain you know, niche press, but it's not necessarily a gigantic worldwide story like I think this one wound up unfolding to be. And part of it, at least in my brain, thinks that is due to the fact that you have these companies that are actually going to space on technology and demonstrating engineering feats that we had thought were decades far away and now are here. Do you think that factors into our excitement for things like this?
I think yes, that I think that the idea that we, now that we're a week after, we have a SpaceX thing land on a drone ship, what's been going on with Bezos and Blue Origin, absolutely helps. Maybe you're right, but I mean, I'm scared to think that, you know, the plan to send a probe to our nearest star system isn't world-worthy news outside
well,
of
well, it. Well, it's not that the idea will always get interest, right? It's that now these things happen and it's not just a press release you read about once and then you never hear about.
Well, okay. So I guess here's the thought experiment that leads me to, unfortunately, I think I disagree, because if $100 million was committed in 1991, before there was any kind of commercial spaceflight happening, then I think it's still would make, and in fact, with Stephen Hawking, if Stephen Hawking and somebody with $1 billion or more committed $100 million to a project that was going to, you know, be an interstellar probe, I'd like to think it would still generate just as much interest. I'd like to think that it's not just because, I mean, as thrilled as I am with SpaceX doing well and Blue Origin having success, I don't know that that's quite the. I think it's largely the scale of the amount of money being committed and this and the nature of the kind of outrageous technology, which, by the way, I'm certain we've talked about what the mechanics are of this. But could you walk us through that again as best as you understand them, Andrew?
Okay, so this what made this possible has been recent developments in laser technology. And the idea is that if you have a laser beam and you hit it against an object, those photons actually have velocity and they impart some kinetic energy onto whatever they hit. It's a very tiny amount, but when they hit an object, they impart that on it. And if you have an extremely powerful laser system hitting an object, it will push that. And if that object is in space and your lasers are in space, or in this case on the ground, and you're putting out, let's say, 100 gigawatts of energy, which is the same amount of energy pretty much given off by the space shuttle when it launches, instead of a spacecraft that has to carry all of its fuel and move the fuel as it's going along, you're only moving your payload. In this case, would be just a microchip with a microsatellite on it and a meter-wide sail, a little target for the lasers to hit. So the lasers hit this thing with 100 gigawatts of energy and push it for 20 minutes. And at the end of 20 minutes, it's going one-third the speed of light. Now, the problem with rockets is you're not only trying to move the rocket, you're trying to move your fuel and everything else. But here you put all of your energy into a laser beam so it doesn't have to carry the fuel, and it's just pure energy is moving this.
So I guess if we're going to take this to its logical conclusion, well, let's say, you know, 300 years in the future, our solar system is just covered in an array of these energy relay stations. Basically, you know, stuff that can shoot light and send stuff ping ponging around, right? So you have essentially something that's largely a sail and a bit of a payload. Let's say it's a Elon Musk. The rocket, you know, you get to orbit fairly cheaply using your reusable, you know, Falcon whatever, and then an array of satellites do 1G. Or maybe a little bit more if you're in a hurry, of pushing you out towards Mars. And then at some point, the Venus relay has a better angle on it, and it starts pushing you on a corrected orbit. And then at some point, 2 days into it, the Jupiter station, the asteroid belt relay or array starts slowing you down to the tune of 1G the entire time, and then you slow down, and then you're in orbit around Mars.
In the broad strokes, absolutely, that's what's exciting. And why not this century? The idea that you could have several of these systems around Earth orbit, and then actually put one around Mars orbit. Because the problem is your lasers are only going to be effective for
One direction, 20, 000, one vector.
Yeah, or 20,000 miles, you know. And so, you know, the one being shooting at you from Jupiter is not going to have much effect. But you would actually, you want to have need to have one to slow you down because you're going really, really fast. But, yeah, I'm all for that. I think we build an interplanetary subway system of these massive light propulsion arrays.
I guess, would it be a silly – it is a silly metaphor. But if you want to understand how this would work, picture the three of us – blowing on a feather, right? Like Andrew blows on it, and he's trying to get it past me to Bryce, and about halfway through, Justin blows on it, and it gets closer. Now I got to slow it down, so I blow it to slow it down, and then it lands right in Bryce's open palm.
Better to just have only – yeah, it's a weird analogy. And it's only probably – you'd have one at the place you're leaving and one at the place you're arriving. Because the lasers aren't going to be very – a laser around Jupiter won't help you if you're trying to get to Mars and you're coming from Earth. Well,
okay, so if you had one – I guess what I worry about – and tell me if I'm wrong about this. Like when you fire something off from Earth with the intention of getting it to Mars, you have to factor in the fact that everything's orbiting. So you may fire in the wrong or in a strange direction. That is the, let's say, the opposite side of the solar system from where Mars is. But well,
your transit time's 3 days.
Right. But it seems to me like having only two directional vectors, one at the origin point and the other at the destination point, it doesn't seem like that would be enough to guide you all the way there. I may be wrong. This may be something we should lean over on Tensor Guy in the chat or something.
Or I could answer if you want, but having read the paper.
Sorry. Go ahead.
And having my own thoughts on this, you would have a wildly elliptical orbit around Mars to do that. You could have a much farther. So you would have a Mars station that would be out there further out to try to hit this at. And so that's your point. It's to understand the effective range of these lasers is several thousand miles. You know, you're beyond that. You know, you're 20,000 miles or so. So. You need to put it around an asteroid or an orbit around the area you're trying to go to.
Got it. What you're saying is the gravitational wells provide the corrective vectors that get you looping around.
If you're trying to shoot a laser from Jupiter, by the time it hits your object heading towards Mars, the size of your beam is going to be larger than the moon, and you're not going to impart any energy onto the object.
Sure. Okay. All right. Wow. So I guess, just the beginning and end point.
Yeah, you could do relays in between. You could put different stations in orbit around the sun. You could have several stations in there and build sort of a railroad effect.
In the case of the interstellar probe, of course, there's no stop vector, right? Everything has to just be – it would have to be just a flyby of Alpha Centauri?
Yeah, it would be a flyby. We'd be sending tons of these probes. We'd be sending a number of these probes towards there. You could continuously be dropping these, you know, every 20 minutes or so, and keep it going.
So I guess that's my question. What is the cost per launch on something like this? Because that's something that we talk a lot about, especially when it comes to private space flight, is how cheaply it can be done compared to how we've done it in the past. This, I imagine, would be a tremendous amount cheaper than, you know, a dirty old rocket.
So your cost is you're going to be launching these from space. So you would have your payloads already up there. Each one of these things weighs grams. And it would be a cost, they say, of like the cost of an iPhone. You know, that's what your cost is for these things.
Now, how do you get the signal back on the cheap? Because by the time it gets to Alpha Centauri, I got to imagine there's an awful lot of interference. There's a lot of awful lot of other noise happening. Do you think? Well, I mean, you probably have read about this too.
Yeah, you're using lasers. You're going to be using lasers to shoot your stuff back. There's I'll refer you again to the paper, which I had a back and forth with the Tensor guy about this.
I mean, I read the paper, but let's just pretend that, you know, I'm guessing Justin probably didn't read the paper.
I've yet to publish my critique, so let's talk about it publicly.
Let's pretend Bryce hasn't read the paper, and let's dumb it down for Bryce.
You're using lasers, guys. You're using lasers for directed back. Instead of like when we're trying to talk to Voyager and other space probes, you're using, you know, we're sending radio waves that are go back everywhere. You're using line of sight directed lasers shooting back at Earth. And so there's an entire section that goes into that. So that's one of the things exciting about this is that the hard parts have been, you know, will this work, whatever. And we still have to figure out, like, there's interplanetary dust, there's interstellar dust, there's galactic levels of dust, all these other things have to factor in to figure out, you know, what are your impact? You know, there's the difference between if your wafer is going edge on towards the direction it's going or if it's straight on towards where it's going. And if it's straight on, you're going to get far more impacts from debris versus if it's on edge. So from an engineering point of view, it's not a settled thing. There are thousands of questions we have to solve and figure out. And that's part of what Milner's $100 billion is going towards is, how do we figure this stuff out?
Sure, you know? Sure. But just in that kind of broad strokes way, you know, like in my mind, a star is putting out so much radiation in so many different parts of the spectrum that it just seems like a gram sized, you know, we're running on a lithium ion battery or nuclear fusion. I don't know what it would be, but it just seems like the ability to beam an image that we could read and translate into a signal on the other side of, you know, 2.5 light years or whatever the distance is, just seems extraordinary. And I guess the first thing that pops in is based on the type of star that you know you're sending it to, you would just broadcast on the parts of the spectrum that star doesn't have a lot of noise.
I mean, you're when you're using a laser, you're going to be at one far end of a spectrum that you're not going to really necessarily worry about the interference like that. And you have a very specific idea of what part of the sky that it's in. You sent this thing on a trajectory, so you have an idea roughly where it is. You could be, and if you're sending a lot of these probes, is you can build sort of a mini array that can communicate backwards. And one of the things Lupin talked about was the idea of we could send one probe towards every degree of the sky in a year just by constantly popping these things out.
Man, that's extraordinary. Like that would be pretty much year zero, the day that the organism of planet Earth suddenly expanded its perception throughout the universe, right? Like that's the beginning of when we see everything around us. I don't know, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean this probe would have a 2 megapixel camera on it and it's doing flybys towards there and we can see what's there. And, you know, we could fly through the solar system there, if there is a solar system, if there are planets, and see what's there, and then we can send stuff. You know, we would get our data back in 4 years, 5 years, 4.5 years, and we know, okay, let's send our next one there, and 20 years later, we can get really accurate data. So,
I guess you would probably do a cloud of them and have them arrive at different times, so maybe the first one, you have to make an important decision where it's like, okay, there are three planets that which one do you want to fly by? Because you can only fly by one, and you got to decide how close you want to fly by. And it's like, okay, now, but you probably wouldn't even have time to get message because your decisions would take 2 years or however long. How far away is Alpha Centauri? 2 or 3 years?
4.5 light years.
4.5 light years, right? So it's like the very commands would take a while. There was one program. It was a bit sensationalist. It was like 10 years ago. It was talking about, you know, I think it was like Walking with Aliens or something like that. It was in the vein of Walking with Dinosaurs. But there was one metaphor that I thought was very, very good, that for humanity, the experience of watching a space probe land or arrive on another planet on another star system would be like standing in the very back row and watching your child do a spelling bee, in that you hoped very much that you trained that child well, but there was absolutely nothing you could do to affect the outcome. And you just had to hope that the artificial intelligence that you created made the kind of decisions that you wanted to get the kind of data that you need out of this. Because it's going to be not in your lifetime will you have the chance to see your next attempt.
There's what's exciting about what we're doing with our next Mars rover is that it's going to be semi-autonomous. It's going to be able to drive itself around Mars so that we don't have to be on the joystick all the time, planning 5 days in advance, you know, on plotting paper where to let it go and do that. And yeah, I think that, you know, what's exciting for me is that within our lifetime, we could be sending probes to star systems, which was for, you know, for all intents and purposes, a year or so ago, if you hadn't, you know, read Lubin's paper, it was, we're talking hundreds of years. The idea that we could do this within this short amount of time, combining the fact that we can now make probes extremely small and the size of a microchip, and two, the developments in what's happened, what's fueled the development in lasers that made this possible has been a lot of the driving forces in fiber optics. And we've increased. You need to have certain materials with high indices of refractivity, because part of the problem is if you're hitting 100 gigawatts at something the size of your kitchen table, it should melt. But if you're able to make a mirror, which we can now with 99.999% ability to reflect, the amount of heat that it absorbs won't melt it. And so there's been all these recent developments now that just – it's a game changer. It's a game changer. And you and Brian, what you just sort of intuited the idea of, what if we put these all over the solar system and we're going around? That might be the be-all best way for us to get around. And in the paper, he gets into explaining why this is probably still going to be more efficient than using antimatter propulsion in the difficulties of that, besides the fact we don't have antimatter. Although there is an antimatter startup called I think Positron Dynamics, which is funded by Peter Thiel, which they have plans to increase the production of antimatter and containment, and they're talking about making rocket ships and all sorts of stuff that are antimatter driven. And this is like, these are real people.
So what I love about this development and this idea, and just to, I don't know, go on a brief side jag about this idea of having an array of different things pushing stuff around, is in Physics of the Impossible by Michio Kaku, he talks about stuff like, and we've talked about this before, I apologize if it's familiar to some of the listeners, but he talks about the idea of moving an object with your mind. Yeah, it's like, look, telekinesis is not real, but let's say we wanted to create the feeling of telekinesis. Well, we can, you know, scan brains. We can figure out what people are concentrating on. We can tell, and there, you know, there's technology that quadriplegics are able to move cursors by thinking about certain things. Separately, you know, we've got wires and strings and magnets and stuff that could do stuff all around. So he posited that, you know, a room in which everything was very precisely arranged and stuff in very specific ways, but you were left with the ability to walk into this room, and as long as you were in this room and you were the tuned in host of it, you could think of an object and move it with your mind. You could do essentially, you know, the stereotypical, you know, TK stuff. It seems like what we want is the ability to hop in our spaceship, treat it like a car, and just drive from point A to point B. And it seems like in a similar vein, we can do this to our universe by creating an array of lasers that push us very, very quickly from point A to point B.
Think about, let's go towards the latter part of this of the century, and imagine a world where we take what we have now and we extrapolate it. You're sitting there and you look at, you've got 2 weeks on your schedule free. And you're like, you know what? I want to go to Mars. And you say, hey, Siri, Alexa, Toby, whatever your artificial intelligence, you know, Bryce 2.0. can I go to Mars? It's like, yeah, Brian, there's actually a slot in the next 9 hours for you to take to go take a, you do the Mars transit. A car, a robot self-driving car pulls up to the front of your house. You walk out. You don't bring anything because, you know, 3D printing and all that is such the point that, you know, whenever you show up in a hotel room, it's going to have your favorite toothpaste and all that ready for you. You hop in this car. It drives you to the airport where you hop up on an electric jet driven by a robot powered by massive solar arrays or fusion or whatever. Energy costs are ridiculously cheap. You're taken to a spaceport where maybe you use a chemical rocket. You could maybe use one of those airship to orbits to get there. You might be maybe use an antimatter space plane to get there, or another option, which I'm under a non-disclosure agreement to tell you about. Okay. Then you fly up to a space station, right? And you get up on this little pod. They put you in this thing that's the size of a little minivan. Maybe there are two other people in there, and you got virtual reality helmets and all sorts of stuff to keep you occupied and maybe really good drugs. They press the button, laser reignites, and you have a 3-day journey to Mars. And along the 3 days there, you could tune out, you could do virtual reality, whatever. And then 3 days later, you're in Mars orbit, and you go to the Mars station and take a landing craft back onto the surface of Mars.
It would be what like a cross-country train trip would be, you know, in the locomotive era of America, like to go from New York to San Francisco or something like that, maybe even shorter than that.
Mm-hmm. And far more things to fill your time with to entertain you because of virtual reality technologies, we can make this interior of the spacecraft that's a tiny craft, because we don't want to take up too much weight. But we can make this thing feel like it's a humongous interior.
Well, and you can even run simulations of what you're going to do when you get there. You can, for example, one of the things when you come to a new city, you familiarize yourself with the city, right? So instead, over that 3-day journey, essentially, they run a version of Grand Theft Auto 5 where it's like you play a game that's sole purpose is to familiarize yourself with the spaceport you're about to land into. And then they give you tasks and you, I don't know, maybe earn money or rewards or something for finishing them. And then along the way, it says, oh, well, you crossed, you violated local laws here. You did that. I mean, it takes all of that locked productivity time that is essentially spent, what, reading Moby Dick or something right now, and makes it all of a sudden productive time that, prepares you for everything. That would be amazing.
We play video games and watch Netflix and sit on our iPads, Brian. I mean, it could be...
No. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of productivity. I mean, of course, entertainment. You can already do that.
Sure. I just love that even in this far flung version of the future, Brian is already girding himself for how future tech will affect the violation of local ordinances.
Well, I mean that's already something. I don't know, whatever. I mean, it's
this is the full picture. A lot of these other science podcasts, they're going to tell you all the cream, right? All the big beautiful dreams.
You wouldn't want to know local traditions or local.
I agree. I totally agree that you're going to spend. You should spend some of that time, on that trip, reading up. But I can tell you, every time I've flown international for 20 hours or something like that, the amount of time that I decided to actually spend reading my little language manuals or what I need to do or know not to do, not as much as I should have.
Well, exactly, because that's my point, is that right now it's work. It's a boring technology. You're reading stuff. You're like, ugh. But instead, if you could essentially feel like you're there already, to where the moment you got off, you've had, two or three days of rehearsal of doing interesting stuff. And then you walk off and all of a sudden you're walking around like a local. I don't know.
That's huge. And there is, I think, a whole larger conversation that we can have about kind of our own decision paralysis in new situations, because it's something that I find very, very fascinating. But I totally get your point.
I do too, Brian.
Right on. High fives all over. All
hey,
around.
You want to know what point I also get as well as everybody else, including Bryce, who's going to show his screen in 5 seconds, is patreon.com/weirdthings.
What is the point of patreon.com/weirdthings?
All right, so here's the deal, right? You just go ahead on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, and you can support this show. A lot of people have been saying forever that, like, hey, what if are we at peak Weird Things? Is Weird Things an unsustainable resource? Well, I am here to tell you that scientific studies now show that we will continue to do Weird Things forever as long as patreon.com/weirdthings continues to thrive. Do your part to conserve, reuse, and recycle Weird Things by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. And making sure that this show happens every single Sunday, as well as After Things, the show in which we reconfigure from news of the weird and science commentators to entrepreneur and business life coaches, and talk about our own pathways as well as helping yours. It's all there for you, friends. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Gentlemen, would you like some weird news? Weird revelation?
Yeah. No, I want to get weird.
Let's go. Okay,
now we have a problem here on this show, and that is that we basically have a wizard running the controls here that I can think about a topic, and there's a good chance that a second later Bryce will have this up on screen.
All right.
Okay.
Wait, that's Bryce, a problem?
Don't do that yet. No, it's okay. Not actually. It's awesome.
I gotcha.
Yeah, you're good. Bryce, by the way, guys, for everybody listening on audio, you do not know how awesome Bryce is when it comes to that. It's like you will be saying, so there's a project, and I'm reading Starshot on the screen because he's already figured it out and got it loaded up, and it's incredible. It is I do not want to get into a shootout with you. just like that. He just threw up a graphic of that. Brian and Justin, and I want the chat room, don't say nothing. Don't say nothing.
Zip it.
Say nothing.
See?
All right.
So, oh, look at this. Brian, look at this. In typical Bryce fashion, he's already removed the chat from the program feed, so none of us know what the chat's saying.
If I say recent news, Loch Ness Monster, does that mean anything to you guys?
No.
No.
What if I told you?
May I make a guess? The new headline is, recent news, Loch Ness Monster, still not real. That's
what if I told you somebody put a robotic submarine into Loch Ness, they looked down there, and they saw the silhouette, the shape of the Loch Ness Monster?
I would say that seems an awful lot like all the other pictures that are not necessarily conclusive and only seem to show this creature in either blur or shadow.
Well, what would you say if I told you this was the same shape, matched the popular description of Loch Ness Monster? Many people would agree, absolutely say yes, this is what Loch Ness Monster would look like.
That's a tough one.
That would certainly match well-documented phenomenon wherein people are taking random patterns and assigning worth to it, and they are noticing it because it is the popular description, not that they have found something that happens to match the popular description. I say good day.
What if I were to tell you this was spotted in the exact location where somebody said, yes, you will find this here?
I would say that this is looking more like a hoax, as we now have somebody that is directing such chicanery and tomfoolery, directing submarines and whatnot to their own folly.
Well, gentlemen, it's all true. A robot submarine in Loch Ness found the Loch Ness Monster.
Wow. Holy cow. As a matter of fact, the headline on CNN says Loch Ness, quote unquote, monster found in Scotland. Hold on.
Oh,
you ruined it. You killed it with that word. All right.
Okay, a survey. Wait, well, hold on. Wow. Okay, a survey team led by Kongsberg Maritime Limited has released a high quality scan of the Loch Ness Monster. Is that?
It does. It looks like Nessie.
Yeah, it does. It really does.
All right, you ready for the backstory on this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a Billy Wilder film called The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which was sort of a more comedic look at Sherlock Holmes, detailing his quirky nature, perhaps his drug addiction, did he like women, etc. And one of the cases in there was a sightings of the Loch Ness Monster that turned out to be a submarine, I think, powered by midgets. And they built a Loch Ness Monster-looking submarine for the movie. They took it out to Loch Ness, but Wilder's like, you know what? I don't like those humps, which are actually there for buoyancy. They took off the humps, and the submarine promptly sank.
Oh, this is amazing! This is a factual finding of an actual Loch Ness Monster.
Yep.
That is amazing.
That's great.
That's one of the. I'm looking at the photos of it now. That's extraordinary.
He's like, autoerotic asphyxiated Loch Ness monster.
That's so great. Here's what I love is that it's a case where it's like enough people want there to be a Loch Ness monster that enough people start fantasizing and creating, you know, imagery of a Loch Ness monster that enough people actually end up sinking and losing Loch Ness monsters that we could go discover later. So it's like the dream becomes reality.
I'm gonna tell you what's gonna make it even more messed up is there's a in California, there's a community that's got these sand dunes there, and buried in the sand dunes is an Egyptian temple, which I think we talked about before, which was I think one of the early productions of Ten Commandments or like a first Ben Hur. I think it was like the first time they did Ben Hur. And then it was eroded away, and then later on when the sand dunes started to erode, you would see what looked like an Egyptian temple in the middle of, you know, California desert, which I used for my book Hollywood Pharaohs. I borrowed that whole entire premise for that. But Brian circa 30-40 years from now is going on his Mars trip and calls up all of his fellow Diamond Head cohorts who Diamond Head, it's a new thing I'm starting. It's what we call them on Mars. Diamond Club.
I like Diamond Head, though.
We launched from Diamond Head, Hawaii. That's where it starts from. So sure. All of the Diamond Club Mars people, we get together out in the desert of Mars, and we're like, guys, you know what would be funny? Let's build a Martian city, right? And we make a little fun movie, whatever, a Patreon campaign. Like, hey, you know, let's build our time machine so we can go back and see if there really were Martians. And then we forget about it. It gets covered. 50, 60 years later, it starts to erode, and people find the Martian city that we made, but they're really confused.
Yeah, well, and that's
let me take that one step further with Loch Ness specifically. Right now, I mean, there's a reason why that phrase Loch Ness monster gets headlines around the world. There is a great interest in the idea of a Loch Ness monster. It has been a part of popular culture on both sides of the Atlantic for a very, very, very long time. Let's flash forward a little bit to a point where you can genetically create animals, maybe cloning or something is in a different place, and you can maybe not to the size of how we imagine Nessie, considering how deep Loch Ness is. There is some kind of creature for which the municipality surrounding that area funds, so as a tourist trap that there is now, by way of the popular legend of Loch Ness Monster, an actual organism for which lives in or around Loch Ness, and every once in a while they throw it in the water and it swims around and everybody takes pictures.
Well, I'll tell you what it makes me think of is like what happens when you reach a constraint-free economy where all of a sudden nobody has to work who doesn't want to, and we have robots to do everything or whatever. And I think I suspect the answer is that we all become artists, and whether your contribution to the art the artistic sphere is to create a hoax that lasts for 100 years or to make an old hoax reality or whatever. I mean, it's like in little ways, we're already doing that.
I think that we certainly, if you look at the amount of time we spend now creating ways to entertain each other, like I can't turn around. Like, you know, you used to think Starbucks were everywhere. Like escape rooms in LA are everywhere now. You know, they're like walking down the street. Wait, there's an escape room there. Get into my apartment. Look, there's an escape room there. So that become a very popular form of way of entertaining ourselves. I certainly see that increasing tremendously.
That's awesome. Well, and it reminds me a bit about we saw that in the Ian M. Banks novel Player of Games, where it's like you know, the culture, this post singularity world, where it's like all you have to do with your time is to gain prestige for being better at playing more types of games than other people and becoming renowned for it.
I think we could do an entire episode one day on the pros and cons of that constraint free economy and you know, the idea of what happens when you don't have to work and you get paid your stipend kind of thing or whatever, and why I think that may be a horrible idea and why it might be a good idea. But
I do know maybe there's a good way to segue into picks, but a recent episode of Freakonomics posed that question, and it came to the science fiction-y twist ending of saying that, hey, well, we have a precedent for this. You know, what happens, because the question is, what happens to jobs when robots can do enough of everything? And their answer eventually got to, sounds nutty, but we've already seen this happen with dogs. Dogs used to have jobs. They used to be, you know, they would herd things. They would provide security. They would do all the stuff that people didn't want to do. And now they don't do any of those things. They still have those instincts. We still deal with them. But pretty much their whole job now is to be kept animals. And, of course, there's more dogs than ever. So I
And we destroy tens of thousands of dogs every day because they don't have a function.
That's well, touche, sir. But yes.
And that's the it's like, yeah, there's a thing that sounds cool, but then there's, from the economics point of view, it's like, do we want a society in which we treat 90% of the population as a parasite?
I don't know. I mean, you say a parasite's an interesting turn of phrase, because it's like I would think we would treat them as customers, because let's say at some point, you know, there's enough wealth and I don't know. Maybe
we should do another episode. I'm all for this. I don't have – no, Brian, this is the way it is. But I have this at first. I'm like, oh, that's a cool idea. But then when I started thinking more deeply about it and reading some several thoughts, I'm like, there's a lot of scary implications there that we could talk about. But I say we dive into pigs.
You know what? Actually, I'll make a pick based on this, because
it's cheating, Brian. It's cheating.
No. My pick, and maybe it's one – it's a book that I read almost 20 years ago. I should probably go back and read it again. But it's Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age, where the opening scene – minor spoilers here, is that a whole bunch of people are gathered around for the inauguration of this island. And this is a case where it's been years and years of effort. They've programmed all the nanobots to create all the items that do all the things. And the architect is there, and I don't know, I'm making this part up, but the mayor's there and everyone's really excited. And then they all gather around, they press button, and the nanobots go to work, and they actually manufacture right in front of you an island with giant diamond sculptures and beautiful, you know, poetic whatever. One of the things that he proposes in this world is that people will split. They will splinter into different cultures because they can afford to be anything. And the Vikis, the Victorians, are a class of people who realize that, hey, well, if we're going to pick just randomly out of any one spot, it seems like the Victorians had a lot of structure to what they're doing, and that we could model, we can live that way. And so Victorians would you know, adopt the language of the late 1800s. They would they had parlor rooms that people would come in and wait before they would be seen by other people. But behind the scenes, what's happening is thousands of nanobots are scrubbing other thousands of nanobots to make sure that there's no viruses or contagions or whatever. And then meanwhile, there were, you know, if you wanted to, you never had to, you know, you didn't have to worry about eating. You didn't have to worry about getting ahead. But if you wanted to contribute to society, that's how you got to be, quote unquote, rich, whatever that means. In a world where you could just ask robots to manufacture atom by atom a diamond of whatever size and shape you want, what does it mean to be rich? So it's like there's prestige of other people, and there's a, you know,
owning land, Brian, same as it's always been.
Maybe so. This is have you read it by any chance, Andrew? Did you ever read The Diamond Age?
I got it. I read years ago, like the first five or six chapters, and it was Stevenson is either like Anathem's one of my favorite 10 sci-fi books of all time. This is one that I just kind of just got into this. I couldn't finish it.
Interesting. But it really stuck with me for a long time. I think I'll go do the audiobook, because I read Snow Crash like 15 years after I read it the first time. I did it again and as an audiobook and loved it. And so maybe it's worth another revisit for me.
Yeah, I listen. Everybody I know who's read Seven Eves loves it, so I'm going to have to read that at some point.
I liked it a lot. I loved Aurora, though. Thematically, Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson is very similar to Seven Eves. Strangely, I found Aurora more optimistic, which is weird because they're both very, very pessimistic novels.
Hey, speaking of optimism, I read a book. I think I might have even shouted out on this show before, but I finished it. It is The Run of His Life. Story of the O.J. Simpson trial, written by Jeffrey Toobin.
Oh, dude, you're diving all the way into the O.J. lore, because I remember it was you that turned me on to that 30 for 30 special, where it was all just found footage from the day that the O.J. trial happened, along with the
I forget the title of that one, but that's one of my favorite documentaries ever. There's another O.J. Simpson 30 for 30 that is like six parts and is apparently insanely good. that has yet to come out. But this is the book for which the television show, the fictional television show, or fictional dramatized, rather, television show is based on. It is certainly extremely well-sourced. Very obviously, the Jeffrey Toobin had access to members of the defense team. He has very good police sources. He quotes things that came from the police file, and it gives you a blow by blow, reasoning on how that trial went the way that it did, and a lot of things that are kind of swept under the rug. If people like the TV show, a few of the things that they point out that the TV show didn't really have much use for is just exactly how well the defense team manipulated the media, which has gone over, but even to the point where there was this idea that behind the scenes OJ was masterminding his defense strategy, that he was and this was very much the creation of Johnny Cochran and Effley Bailey and Shapiro, that like he was the one really like saying who they should call and this, that, and the other, which was a complete fabrication. OJ, to nobody's surprise, beyond everything that trial became, beyond the actual crime that was committed, was kind of just a dumb athlete. Whether or not he was a murderer, spoiler alert, he was. He barely the note that he wrote that was read by Robert Kardashian on television and then subsequently published in newspapers and magazines across the world was almost uniformly corrected for grammar and spelling and obscured the fact that OJ was almost functionally illiterate. The note itself is just rife with spelling errors and grammatical errors, and the idea that that at that point it was the decision of maybe 20 people to just correct that when they were writing it into actual newspaper copy or magazine copy is just crazy, because you could only imagine that would just be people would take pictures and post it on Twitter immediately, and that would be a lot clearer in today's world than it was back in the mid-90s. There's a lot of really fascinating things there, and the O.J. Simpson trial obviously now going through it is apparently crossed through our vein of, hey, that was a thing that happened, to, hey, this is nostalgia and let's pick it apart. But listen, it is weirder than you think. Like, as much as you remember the O.J. Simpson trial, man, it is so, so, so bizarre to look at that trial, which was, I think, very much undeniably the cross-section of a lot of elements in pop culture, and very specifically the media.
There was a great article by Vincent Bugliosi after that, explaining his it was, the headline was, "I could have convicted O.J. Simpson with a legal pad and a pencil." It was just,
yeah, and that's
very much a good dismantling after the fact. But since then, all the others are the details.
Without a doubt, and that book is unkind to Marcia Clark and Christopher Darden specifically. Marcia Clark comes off in the book, and from anybody that can tell, she was a fierce, almost like, superhero-esque, kind of like driven to justice for victims kind of prosecutor that just wound up getting buffaloed in that trial for a million different reasons, and many of them very much of the prosecution's own making. But I found it fascinating. It's really, really, really well written, and certainly does not dance on any lines on spelling out just exactly how much overwhelming evidence there was to point to O.J. Simpson having murdered Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman.
Did you do the audiobook or actually read the text?
Oh, these eyes don't read anymore.
Yeah, dude, I'm so with you. And it's like, I'm so over people acting as though the ability to look at printed text and translate it into the meaning of the words behind it is some kind of precious gift. And we're all in sixth grade and we're impressed that you can read very long books or whatever. It's like, I ain't got time for that. It's like, I experience vivid hallucinations because I have the world's best storytellers who've read the book ahead of time and know the right things to emphasize, put on a mind production in my brain while I deal with the tedium of meat space.
Yeah, well, I thought it was very, very, very well read. So check it out. Run of His Life by Jeffrey Toobin.
I think they both have their value for format.
Stop fighting the line.
From somebody whose majority of my work is not out on ebook or audiobook, rather.
Yet.
Although, guess what comes out this week? This week, Name of the Devil on Audible.
Oh, sweet, 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 sweet. I had no idea. I'm so very excited about
this. Name of the Devil. Name of the Devil, by the way, Thriller Award nominated book, the sequel to Angel Killer, but you can read it standalone. Angel Killer's on Audible too. Name of the Devil is an Audible book, audio book.
That is wonderful. Is there any of the behind the scenes you can talk about that? Because, is it the same reader and
same reader we had before? So,
great.
Narrator.
No, I love it. Reader. Check. Yeah, no, I sound like an idiot. This is one of the biggest flaws of me as a human being is I've been friends for a decade now with Andrew Main, but yeah. It wasn't until there was an audiobook that I could actually.
I wouldn't call that a flaw. But...
Big flaw. We could keep going and just name flaws. You want to go, Andrew? You want to start?
There's no shortage.
My pick is not Name of the Devil, although I hope it's all of your picks. If you guys go in there and click that as Audible,
buying it right now.
Yep, me too.
It will help me out a lot. They track those numbers or buy it on Amazon. Buy the CD. Buy the 8-track. My pick is another look back, nostalgic look about sort of the beginning of reality TV, commercial culture. How our attention's captivated and driven by competition reality. And I'm talking, of course, about the movie available now on Netflix, The Running Man, written by an obscure novelist known as Richard Bachman. At least that's what his name is in the titles for this. And it is a remarkably fun movie that I think holds up in many ways, directed by Paul Michael Glaser, who is from Starsky & Hutch, actually. It's a funny movie, and Richard Dawson in it is playing this sort of preening reality TV host kind of guy, you know, in the age of, what we have now is surprisingly entertaining. I'm enjoying Maria Conchita Alonso at peak. Maria Conchita Alonso is amazing. So The Running Man is my pick.
Well, and it was a weird line that he played when he in that role, because this is at the height of his popularity or near the end of his popularity as the host of Family Feud. And before then, mm-hmm. throughout all the 70s, he had
already kissed all the moms.
Correct.
In America on the lips.
He had appeared as guests on all of the game shows. So this is somebody who was a well-beloved institution in game show television, essentially playing a really horrific caricature of what he already was. And I remember, it's been a long time since I watched it, but I remember finding it really disquieting as a kid to see him, you know, essentially playing himself, but just with the right amount of darkness and bloodlust and pragmatism. I don't know. It was kind of horrifying.
So,
but it was.
Sorry, go ahead. Explain.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh no! I was gonna go in another direction. So let's get all the Running Man analysis in.
No, I just gonna say that it was neat because remember Dawson was a guy that remember he's in Hogan's Heroes. This is a guy that had a history as an actor who then fell into the game show thing, which is if you're a successful game show host, an extremely lucrative career, and you kind of never want to step away from it because what you do. And for him to then go do Running Man and to sort of just take the piss out of that character and play this guy that's super nice to everybody. And then, you know, the moment, you know, some guy with the mop crosses him, he's, you know, telling him to fire him when he's in the elevator. I mean, it's a caricature, but it's really, really good.
How has this movie not been remade?
I
be careful what you say.
Yeah, I'm certain somebody has it optioned at some level. There is only one Richard Bachman tale that has not been made into a movie yet. And it's The Long Walk. That's correct. Everything else has been made into a fairly big property. I gotta feel like it's kind of like the Philip K. Dick thing, where it's like, you know, there's fresh turf to be mined before they start doing retreads.
No, there's been plenty of attempts to try to put this into being remade, because it's been the Bachman stuff has been pretty, has made interesting material. You're going to be hard pressed to find a relatively faithful Philip K. Dick adaptation that did really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you outside know. Of Blade Runner, but that probably violates
that's
the faithful.
That's not a faithful adaptation.
Yeah.
That's we take the source material and we make something radically different from the book. And then I think things like, I thought Adjustment Bureau was pretty good. There's been some other stuff that it's gotten better, but a lot of his stuff is just so weird. But yeah, when it comes to faithful, you know, Blade Runner had to just take this premise and then change it dramatically. And that was not an economically successful film when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I just kind of feel like this is like, between like, you know, like Hunger Games meets Deadpool. Like we could do a rad Running Man movie. Like that would, they could be a big hit these days, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. I'm down. I'm for it.
Yeah. Arnold's hinted at it. You could do a version of it where Arnold was playing the game show host.
That'd be perfect. We can all agree that we need the big, like Arnold defined his final act as an actor, right? Like where he just like settles into the kinds of roles that are befit him. And I think he's kind of tried to fit himself, wedge himself kind of back into the action thing, which has not necessarily been super successful, but I would love to see him just like on charm alone, just rock a role like that. I think that'd be great.
That'd be cool. And he could do all the one-liners. Now, like Running Man is really, part of what I loved about it is like how it sort of just kind of got TV. There's a moment where, spoiler alert, Arnold is this guy sent into this dystopian version of LA where they have these stalkers who try to kill him and other game players there. And there's like the point where he makes his first kill, right? And then like he surprisingly kills the guy in the hockey rink with barbed wire on the guy's neck. And it cuts back to the studio audience and everybody's sad because their favorite stalker's been killed. And Richard Dawson's like, well, you know, we'll be right back after these commercial messages. this national tragedy has befallen us as our beloved mass murdering hitman has been killed before our eyes. And then it's like, you know, the sad music's already queuing, and like, oh, and it's like if you go back and you watch Verhoeven Starship Troopers and you realize how clever that movie was.
Yeah,
it's the same sort of thing.
Absolutely.
You know? So anyhow, gentlemen, let's say we wrap this up and jump into some after things where I'm gonna have my special guest Peter Wax. So I'm going to say it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.